From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Orville Schell has researched and written about China for over four decades, both as a journalist and an academic.
The party now, which really has no ideology other than nationalism, is almost completely based for its legitimization on the economy working. It's funny for a communist party to be totally reliant on a marketized capitalist economy for its legitimacy.
And I'll talk with Rebecca Cruz about recent mass protests in Romania and how the government responded.
They see this as a larger movement against corruption. They are concerned about where this could potentially be going. And this may not be ending anytime soon. There have been protests every night for the last week.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlott. Rebecca Cruz, let's talk about protests, but in a different part of the world this week. Mass protests in Romania, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets all over the country protesting two government proposals that, in effect, would reduce the sentences of those in office that had been convicted of corruption. This was a huge issue because there's been so much corruption in this country since its independence, and the people have had it. Tell us what's going on there.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story, and the visuals are remarkable. The largest protest since 1989, the toppling of the Ceausescu regime, in over 50 cities this past Sunday, topping out at about 500,000. But even throughout the rest of the week, protesters in blizzard-like conditions, really passionate about what's going on here. There were protests about a year and a half ago in 2015 along similar lines that actually toppled the government there. And so they just here recently have a new government in place. They were there for about a year with a temporary government. So their new prime minister has been in power about 3 weeks. And as you said, he was putting forward, or his party is putting forward legislation that would alter some of the corruption. And a lot of the suspicion here is that this would help him, would help his colleagues, would help those that have gotten him to power. So that's the reaction here. And even though they've come out and said, okay, we're going to not put this legislation forward, we're going to open it up for debate, they still continue to protest because they see this as a larger movement against corruption. They are concerned about where this could potentially be going. We've seen the resignation of the justice minister out of this. And this may not be ending anytime soon. There have been protests every night for the last week.
So they are really sustaining these efforts. And I think that's one of the things when you read interviews with the protesters about the importance of sustaining the demonstrations and sustaining the presence in the streets. But let's just back up a second. I mean, Rebecca, you and I have both had experience in Romania at different times. I was there for a while in the early 2000s, and you were there a little later in that decade. But I know I, for one, saw the massive amount of corruption that you would see on a daily basis in the streets. And I was there to interview officials, and I felt like it was a very corrupt environment. I didn't pay any bribes. I didn't have to do that. But you hear stories about having to pay bribes to school teachers and hospital officials to get anything done, that people had to be bribed. Now, that's also a reflection of their economy and the fact that people aren't paid well for what they do. They have economic issues. But when I was actually in a car with public officials, they caused a car accident and didn't stop. And I said, hey, don't you need to like stop? They actually caused an accident to happen. And they were like, nope, no need. And so, I mean, it was just this kind of, we can operate with impunity. We are not accountable. We don't have to be held accountable. And the people now are saying, no, we are going to hold you accountable.
Well, it's interesting that there's so many comparisons made to 1989, because yes, there were a lot of people in the streets. And that was a relatively somewhat violent protest, much more so than we saw in Czechoslovakia, for example. But what the aftermath of that is important for what we're talking about now, because there really was not this process of removing officials, of lustration, of going through and getting rid of people that had been involved in the old system. And so that corruption stayed in place and continued into their democratic phase. Now, you were there in the early 2000s. I was there in 2007 and 2008, so just as they joined the European Union. And as part of the European Union, this was a big issue. There were many questions as to why they were allowed to join, considering their history of corruption. And they've made significant progress in the last 8 or 9 years on this. And so, yes, this is a reaction to what they see as going backwards, as going back to how it was. There have been anti-corruption committees and, as I said, protests a year or so ago. And hundreds of people involved in higher level positions have been targeted. There are many that have been indicted. So they've made great progress on this. And this is seen as backsliding.
Well, clearly, Romania is one of those countries that really didn't have a very strong civil society. This is why some of this is also really surprising and interesting. But I'm wondering now, I mean, Romania is not the only corrupt regime in the region or certainly in the world, that this is evidence of people power. This is evidence of people coming out, showing force by just being there, by being a body in the street. Will this change the nature of protests perhaps in other parts of the world? Will we see this kind of thing spread as we have seen it spread in Eastern Europe before?
It's really hard to say. The government that came to power is the PDS, and they are known as a populist party. So we've seen some other things in Brexit and elsewhere in the world, really that populism. So what the concern might be is not that this will affect protest, but that this populism that we've seen elsewhere will take over in Romania. But so far, the Romanian protesters and the government in power have been very pro-Europe. And so they don't want to take the road that they see Hungary taking, which is populism anti-Europe. So perhaps this is a warning sign. This is an empowerment that others in the region will take note of, and perhaps that the government will reevaluate what's going on here. So far, even though the justice minister has stepped down, the new prime minister he seems pretty confident in what he's doing, and it's not likely that he's going to resign, even though that is the ultimate call right now.
All right. Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for your insight on this. As always, we will continue to watch Romania, undoubtedly.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU and at Suzette Gorelot. Next, I'll talk with Orville Schell. He's the director of the Center for U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society. He's also a former dean at the University of California, Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. I'm Suzette Gorelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelot. Orville Schell has been writing about China since 1970. He is the author of 15 books and an award-winning journalist who has worked for Frontline and 60 Minutes on CBS. Orville Schell, welcome to Worldviews.
Pleasure to be here.
So, Orville, you've had a long career studying China, and largely as a journalist. I want to get there in just a few minutes, but tell us how you ended up working in China, because you spent time in Taiwan in the early 60s and obviously have been working in and out of China for many, many years. You were there during the Tianemen Square incident, in 1989. So tell us a little bit about how you developed an interest in this part of the world, kind of what took you there to begin with.
Well, I think it was very much happenstance that led me to China, because when I was in college, you couldn't go there. So it was a bit of a terra incognita, I think the very fact that I couldn't go there was most interesting to me. And I stumbled into a very legendary course on China and Japan taught by John Fairbank and Edwin Reischauer at Harvard. And by the time I got to the end of it, I didn't really know what else to do with myself and was very sort of mystified by the Chinese language. So ultimately, I dropped out of college twice to go study Chinese and on Taiwan. And then I was sort of stuck on it.
I love that it was more or less prohibited, therefore you found it interesting and wanted to go. But the language being mystifying to you, were you able to study the language in college? Is that how you were exposed to that and ultimately, led you to study something kind of unusual?
I didn't. I actually went out to Stanford to study one summer, and I got absolutely nowhere. I mean, as I think often studying a language, particularly like Chinese or Japanese, an Oriental language, in America is very hard, particularly spoken. So I ended up working on a ship and going out to Taiwan, and I spent 2 years there. And that lived with seven other Chinese roommates. So that was a good language lesson.
What are some of the most compelling issues today? I've heard you refer to things like the relationship with Tibet, the concerns there. Obviously, Taiwan is an issue. What about human rights? You've been involved in Human Rights Watch, for example. I mean, what are some of the things that are going on in China and between China and the United States that we should really be paying most interest to today?
Well, after, a century of China being relatively weak and feeling very much the victim, occupied by Japan, sort of pecked apart by the great powers, it finally has now become much more prosperous and powerful. So one can say that China has actually risen, and it has gotten to be, with the United States, one of the two most consequential countries in the world today. But it does have a very different political system and a very different value system. And this complicates our relationship with it immensely, whether you're talking about Tibet or Taiwan, which is a democracy, or Hong Kong, which does have it has been guaranteed a certain amount of autonomy and a free press and other sort of Western institutions. This is a source of enormous contention between the U.S. and China. So at the same time, we have this great disparity in what we believe in and the way we govern ourselves, and questions like human rights, rule of law, academic freedom, you can go on and on and on. We also have other problems which are incredibly demanding, such as nuclear proliferation, pandemics, world epidemics, climate change, world trade, that also the world simply can't manage unless the U.S. and China can cool down and cooperate. So it presents an enormous contradiction. It's an enormous challenge, and we haven't got it figured out. And in fact, I would say in the last 3 or 4 years, relations between the U.S. and China have degraded, and there's more tension now than there were, say, 5 years ago.
Why have things gotten worse over the past few years?
Well, I think the most obvious cause of the tensions are the fact that China now is much more prosperous and powerful, and now has begun to have a military that can project power, not just a defensive land army, but a navy and an air force. And they have declared that most of the South China Sea is their sovereign territory, which is, on one level, if you look at the map, it looks quite outrageous. It goes all the way down to Indonesia. And they also claim islands that Japan claims. So here you have the two strongest powers in Asia at loggerheads, and we have, we are bound by a treaty with Japan, with Korea, with the Philippines to defend them. So, and each of these countries has pieces of real estate that are in contention.
Years ago, we would talk about China and that they're growing in wealth and power. They're obviously, upgrading their military. The fact that they're more able to project that power, that naval power, the growth into the South China Sea is obviously a significant concern. What is it that the United States can or is doing about this? I mean, it's degraded their, as you mentioned, their relationship. There's more concern and fear. I don't know how much trust there is between these two countries, but they need each other, right? And so what is it that the United States can or will do about this situation, given, as you noted, all of the treaties with the neighbors?
Well, this is of course the question. We don't want to draw lines in the sand and then just ignore them. But as a result of China's much more forward and aggressive posture in maritime disputes, both in the East and South China Sea, every single nation, which was once China had cultivated quite nicely in a friendly fashion. It went back in the days of its so-called peaceful rise, like Vietnam, Philippines, Singapore, Malaysia, are now much more inclined to ask the United States for support, assurances of protection, because they're small, they're weak, and China's big and powerful, and there's no other place to turn to. So we find that the whole region has been catalyzed into a kind of Cold War situation. At least it looks that way to the Chinese, these alliances between the United States and its neighbors. And it's an understandable thing because they feel threatened.
And what is it they feel threatened by whom? I mean, their neighbors, they feel threatened by the United States. I mean, you noted their aggressive positioning, right? The fact that they seem to be aggressively pushing themselves outside of their own territory, at least within their region. However, they're also heavily investing in Latin America, in Africa, and other parts of the world. So there appears to be some sense of if projecting their power even further, at least in terms of economic influence, financial influence, investment. So what is it that they're threatened by? Is it a matter of threat, or are they just being aggressive and perhaps just pushing their own agenda, not because they're feeling threatened, but because perhaps they want to threaten the position of others?
Well, I think at last, having been sort of the victim, having been the one that was preyed upon, chipped away at, occupied, and they feel they have been bullied and hectored, that now that they are powerful enough, there's a certain kind of, I think, they feel with a certain sense of gratification that it is they that can set the terms of the game. And I think back in the day, I mean, China has a long historical memory of the time when it was the only game in town. And town, as they knew it then, was Asia. They didn't know about the West. So then when the West came and was more powerful and China suddenly was weak and couldn't defend itself, this was a bitter period of Chinese history. So now that they're back, they're capable of doing things, there's an enormous temptation to sort of project power, not necessarily for a kind of a hard, realistic evaluation of their own interest, but because they can. And because that's sort of assumed to be their natural role, to be the first, not even among equals, just the first. And that's the role they are now starting to play. The only problem is, of course, that there's another extremely powerful country, both economically and militarily in the region, Japan. And then, of course, there's Korea. And then, of course, there's Vietnam, which when China attacked them in 1979, got their clock cleaned by this little country. They're pretty feisty, you know, small. But there's an awful lot of fracture points now in that area. And the U.S., who's been out there with the Seventh Fleet for 70 years, is sort of the policeman on the block. And so you ask, what should we do about it? If I could answer that question, I would be Secretary of State.
That's Orville Schell. He's the former dean of the University of California, Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism, and director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society in New York. After the break, we'll talk about the potential for domestic fractures in China. I'm Suzette Gorlat, and you're listening to Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat, the dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. My guest is Orville Schell, who has been researching and writing about China since 1970. Well, this is obviously a very large country and diverse, too. You have, I mentioned earlier in the discussion, Tibet, other minority issues, Uyghurs. You know, there seems to be the potential for some sort of domestic fracture as well. And I also mentioned your presence during the Tiananmen Square incident in 1989. I mean, what kind of movements like those are emerging? Are they emerging? Or, you know, do we see that the Chinese government is really able to keep these types of movements and concerns, domestic issues, at bay?
Well, traditionally and presently, I think that China, the Chinese Communist Party's most sort of frightening scenario is disunity. And of course, the Communist Party came to power promising to reunify China. That meant Tibet, Xinjiang, the Uyghur Muslim areas, Mongolia, Manchuria, and Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Macau. So this was a very sort of important promise. And it also touches on the issue of sovereignty, probably the most sensitive issue for Chinese in terms of foreign policy. But while they're very afraid of disunity, there also are a tremendous number of very dangerous fracture points within China. There's the ethnic one, regional one. There's also a yawning abyss now as it becomes more capitalistic and wealthy of between the rich and the poor. And the party now, which really has no ideology other than nationalism, is almost completely based for its legitimization on the economy working. It's funny for a communist party to be totally reliant on a marketized capitalist economy for its legitimacy, but that's the reality. So they're very, very nervous. that the country could fracture again, could break apart into both demonstrations like 1989, into economic grievance, into people angry about the horrendous pollution. I mean, people who are poor, people who lose jobs when the economy turns down. And it's a real powder keg, and one has to sort of, you know, admit that the Chinese Communist Party has its hands full keeping this whole train on the tracks.
Well, I have to admit, from my time in China, the socioeconomic divide and those types of divisions that you're referring to are not as easy to see unless you get outside of the big cities, right? When you spend your time in Beijing or Shanghai, you don't really see them. But that rural-urban split really seems to be, I mean, kind of what we're getting at, right, in terms of that socioeconomic distinction. I mean, the overwhelming majority of the country is still, you know, living outside of these urban centers. And is that the place where a lot of these environmental externalities end up?
Well, the cost of China's very high-speed growth has been a tremendous amount of environmental degradation, both in terms of air quality, water pollution. 10-15% of all arable land in China has been now rendered too toxic, mostly by polluted irrigation water, to farm on. I mean, that's an extraordinary figure. You find groundwater levels sinking, rainfall patterns changing, rivers just running black as tar. It's a horrendous situation. So there's that whole problem, which has hardly started to come home to roost. And then you have on top of that the fact that China's poor peasantry has comprised the largest migration in human history going into the cities. But if the economy slows down and they can't keep the people now who are sort of members of this floating population in the city employed, they risk tremendous instability. So there are all of these kinds of changes that have come about. You know, you patch something with one kind of patch and then it rips and you have to use another kind of patch. So they're running around, you know, one problem generates another. And it's a very unresolved society. Because you have to remember, it is coming from being a centralized economy, a Marxist-Leninist system with a very tectonic Maoist revolution, and it's changing into something else. And what that something else is not yet clear, but it's in myriad ways in a state of transition.
All right, Orville Schell, thank you so much for being here and sharing your perspective with us today.
Thank you.
Listening to my conversation with Orville Schell. He's the director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society in New York. You can find more information online at kgou.org and subscribe to our weekly podcast. Worldviews is part of a partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Sam Dupre produced the show, and Jacob McClellan edited this interview. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Corlatt.